Good morning, everyone. This is Ken Barney. Welcome you to This Week in Palestine. Each week at this time, we present this 45-minute program, which is a selection of news and discussion about the struggle of the Palestinian people against the ongoing colonization and ethnic cleansing of their homeland. And of course, the perspective we offer here is not to be found in the mainstream media. The late Sharif Fahm was the creator of this program, and we continue to mourn the loss of our friend Sharif. He produced this program for many years, but now we have a small group of us, his friends and colleagues, who are keeping this program going in his memory. This morning we're actually not going to have a live interview, and instead we're going to play a 33-minute talk given by the great Israeli historian Ilan Pappe. That's spelled P-A-P-P-E. This is one of the talks given a few weeks ago in Stuttgart, Germany. Yes, I did say Stuttgart, Germany. I'll say a word about Ilan Pappe and about Germany in a moment. But first, about this conference. Over 200 participants came together in Stuttgart for this three-day Palestine Solidarity Conference. There were lots of German activists and also people from six other Western countries. But the main speakers were Germans and Palestinians. The Palestinian speakers included the following people: Haidar Aid from Al-Aqsa University in Gaza, Mazen Kumsieh, who is now at Birzeit in Ramallah. He used to live in the Boston area. Ali Abunama, who's the co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. Ali lives in Chicago. And finally, the Palestinian activist Lubna Masarwa from Jerusalem. And Lubna is one of the leaders of the Free Gaza movement. Actually, you can watch all of these talks in video online. You can find them quite easily. Just do a search and put in three words, Stuttgart, Palestine, and then the speaker's last name, and the videos will come up for you in various formats. Now, Ilan Pappe, the great historian, has written several important books, but is best known at this point. His latest book is entitled The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. Ilan is originally from Haifa. He taught at the University of Haifa for many years, but he was facing increasing hostility, and which included his children. His children were facing hostility, and it was unremitting. And finally, Ilan felt that he and his family had to leave Israel. So now they live in England, where Ilan teaches at the University of Exeter. Before we put on Ilan's talk, I want to say just a few words about the significance of the location of this conference in Germany. It's indeed significant. We know that the greatest resistance against facing the horror being brought on the Palestinian people for 63 years now is in the United States and Germany. It's in all Western countries, of course, yes, but especially in the United States and Germany. Edward Said described a huge part of this problem many years ago. Edward argued that the tragedy of the Jews in Europe, which peaked in the Holocaust, or some call the Shoah, also culminated in the Palestinian tragedy, the Nakba. And Edward went so far as to say that the Jewish tragedy led directly to the Palestinian catastrophe, adding, of course, that the Palestinians, and I quote, do not bear any blame for the destruction of European Jewry, unquote. Of course, we know that this argument is being made constantly by Palestinians, over and over and over again, but has never seemed to count for much in the Western world, including the United States and Germany. But we are seeing cracks in this resistance opening up, and we see it happening here in the United States. In Germany, however, the problem has been overwhelming for the obvious reasons that the Germans, for over a half century now, have been dealing with the legacy of the horror story created in Germany during the first half of the 20th century. Still now, the German government seems immovable now. I mean, their leaders remain totally biased toward Israel, and, you know, obscenely so, something like what we see here in the United States. But the German population is another story. It's different. And we are now seeing cracks finally opening up over there. That's in the population, not the government. And so, you know, this conference was in Stuttgart, Germany. And you know, a conference like this taking place in that location is really another hopeful sign. There's much more to be said about this, but now we'll listen to Ilan Pape.
Begin by thanking the organizers. I know it took quite a lot of effort to bring us all together, and it's a great achievement, and as Mazen and Haidar mentioned and Lubna mentioned yesterday, you also provided a great opportunity for us to meet. And we are very grateful to you for this opportunity to meet you and to meet each other. It's easier because of the Israeli oppression to meet here than to meet in Palestine, where we should meet. And hopefully one day we all be there without the need to go to frozen hills of Stuttgart to create a joint life. And I think that's the gist of the Zionist story, that it doesn't allow people to lead normal life and to be normal friends, that they need to go through all that hardship in order to fulfill a very elementary human impulse to live together. We live in very bizarre times. On the one hand, we could not have wished as activists for a better Israeli government. I think that this particular government makes any sophisticated analysis of what Zionism in Israel is all about quite redundant. It's very easy to expose not only the Israeli policies, but also the racist ideology behind them. On the other hand, Israel is the most successful economy in the West in the last 3 years. It has done much better than Germany, much better than most of the economic powers of the West. Its banking system is very stable. Its currency is one of the strongest in the world. And it doesn't suffer at all from all the hardships that have affected the Western economy and capitalist economy in the last 3 years. The result is a very bewildering gap between what average and decent people in the West think about Israel and the way the Israelis, especially the Israeli Jews, think about themselves. They think that they live in a very successful society. They believe that the Arab-Israeli conflict is over, that the Palestine question has ended. Yes, you have a problem in Gaza. Yes, you have a problem with Hezbollah in Lebanon, but this is a global problem. It's not a particular Israeli problem. This is part of the so-called war against terror. We also live in bizarre times because, despite, and Haidar talked and Mazen talked about it yesterday in very detailed way, so I don't have to repeat it, we also live in a time where particular and specific Israeli policies are severely criticized. People go and demonstrate against the massacre in Gaza. People go and demonstrate against the attack on the flotilla to Gaza. And yet, nobody dares to attack the ideology that is behind these policies. There is no demonstration against Zionism, because the European Parliament even regards a demonstration against Zionism as anti-Semitism. Imagine, in the days of apartheid South Africa, if you were not allowed to demonstrate against the apartheid in South Africa, but only against the Soweto massacre. And this is still a great Israeli success, and Germany plays a very important role in this success, that the main problem and the main reason for the criminal policies is not analyzed, is not discussed, is not touched upon, only the symptoms. I'm not a doctor, I'm not a physician, but I know that if you deal with the symptoms and not with the cause of the illness, you don't cure the patient. So I think that what we really need as activists, and it's easier to talk to you than I think to talk to people who know nothing about the conflict or are totally on the other side of the coin, that we have to change a little bit what we are doing. Not in terms of our very successful BDS campaign, or the kind of things that we do in Germany and elsewhere in solidarity with the Palestinian people. I think this is an impressive chapter in European civil society activity, no less impressive, as was pointed out yesterday, than the chapter in the struggle against apartheid. But we are still, most of us, are still not using the right language. Most of us are still not employing the kind of dictionary that we should employ in order to drive the message home of what are we dealing with. Because one of the greatest paradoxes of what goes on in Israel and Palestine is that, on the one hand, it's not a complicated story. We've been there before. European settlers coming, either genociding or kicking out the indigenous people. The Zionists have not invented anything new in this. And on the other hand, Israel succeeded, with the help of its allies everywhere, including in this country, to build this complex explanation that is so complex that only they can understand it. And you are not allowed to interfere, especially if you are Germans. You are not allowed to interfere in this analysis because it's very complex. No, it's not. It is really not complex. And this is why history is so important. Understanding the not so complex history of what the Zionist movement was and is doing to the indigenous native people of Palestine is what the story is all about. Yes, there are other stories connected to it, I agree. The fate of the Jews in Europe, the Holocaust, I don't know, the relationship between Christianity and Judaism over the last 2,000 years. But these are sidebars. These are not the main story. They belong to the story, but you don't begin this. This is why in Israel, even unfortunately Palestinian students who are Israeli citizens, when they learn about the history of their own country, they begin in Odessa. I remember my Palestinian students in the university saying, can you explain to us why we, who were born in Mrar or Sakhnin, or in the Nakab, have to begin our history in Odessa. They didn't even know where Odessa was. And I said, that's because you are under occupation, even inside Israel. Not just in the West Bank, not just in the Gaza Strip. Palestinians inside Israel are also under occupation. And are also under colonization. And if we don't understand this, we will not break the deadlock. Because what is called the peace process that began in 1967 is taking place on Mars, on the moon. This is the only peace process in history that I know of that had no relevance whatsoever with the problem it was supposed to solve. What they were talking about in Geneva in 1977, in Madrid in 1991, in Oslo in 1993, had very little to do with the essence of the problem. It dealt with the symptoms, I agree. It dealt with the symptoms, but not with the essence. And this is the second greatest Israeli success. That not only the public opinion does not deal with the essence, but also the peace process very successfully succeeds in avoiding it. So if you go back to history, and you are using today the right language, you are not anachronistic, as someone was trying to say this morning. You are not anachronistic. You are actually a very relevant, updated person. I'll explain what I mean. If you say that Zionism is colonialism, you are the youngest and most updated student of history I've met. Anyone who will try to deter you by saying this is anachronism, this is not helpful, this is anti-Semitism, is anachronistic and lives on the moon or in Mars and can continue to talk about something which has nothing to do with what's going on the ground. Actually, if you know Hebrew, you know that the whole Hebrew language from 1882 until today, which was constructed to describe what the Zionist movement is doing in Palestine, uses again and again the word hityashvut, hitnachalut. And the only way of translating these words is to colonize. There's no other translation. So the Zionist movement in the late 19th century, when colonialism had a very good public relations, was very gladly using the word to colonize. But then they learned that colonialism was not so popular. So they translated it differently. They found the word settlement, which means something else in English. And they found the word, they said, yes, it's colonized, but it's not like colonized. It's a different kind. Again, it's complex. And only we, the Israeli Jews, understand why Israeli colonization and white colonization in Africa is not the same. If you're not an Israeli Jew, you don't understand it. If you're not a Zionist Israeli Jew, of course you cannot understand it. And I think this is important to bring back in our teaching in schools, in our approach to the public, in our negotiations with the political elite in this country and in the West, to say to them, you are dealing with the last colonialist project. And as bizarre as it sounds, even in the 21st century, this colonialist project employs the same tactics of colonialism in the 19th century. And I think that every decent person in the West, like in the time of colonialism, would not stand on the side of colonialism. But you have to clean your language. You have to clean your mind, and you have to think that it's totally irrelevant what people say about what you say. It doesn't matter what they say. They will regard you as anti-Semitic even if you support the two-state solution. Because it means you don't support the two-state solution as they understand it. Because you don't understand the problem. You think that the two-state solution is a sovereign, independent state over the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. No, you don't understand it. The state for the Palestinians are two Bantustans divided to 12 in the West Bank, contained in, like in the concentration camp in Gaza, has no connection between it, has a little municipality in Ramallah which would be called the government. This is a state. And if you don't understand that this is a state, it shows that you still have to learn about the complexity of the conflict. Now, colonialism is one message from the past that we should accept and we should deal with. And we should recruit the veteran as well as the younger cohorts of activists to work for something which universally should be very easy to recruit people for. The fight against colonialism. The fight against the idea that someone from the outside has the right to demolish the life of people in the inside. And they have done it in 1882, they have done it in 1948, and they have done it yesterday in the Nakab or in the West Bank, and they're going to do it next week if we will continue to talk about peace negotiations, two-state solutions, all kinds of irrelevant concepts that have nothing to do with the realities on the ground. The second concept from the past, which I think we should insist on conveying to people, whether we try to protest against something that Israel is doing today, or whether we will commemorate in January what Israel had done in the Gaza Strip, or when we commemorate in May the crime that Israel committed in 1948. And this is the ethnic cleansing. It is a concept that was developed, of course, in the 1990s more clearly because of what happened in the Balkan Wars. But even before that, this was regarded by the international community as an unacceptable ideology and policy. Only genocide is regarded by the international community as worse than ethnic cleansing. And quite often the two are interconnected, as we can see in other places and as we can see in Israel and Palestine. When you are allowed to pursue a policy of ethnic cleansing, don't be surprised if these perpetrators would one day move to genocide. Because in both cases, you have to totally dehumanize the people you are expelling or massacring. Even if they are children, they have to be totally dehumanized. And anybody who lived in Israel long enough, as I did, knows that the main corruption of people through the military service is the total dehumanization of the Palestinians. That's why a soldier, when he sees a Palestinian baby, he doesn't see a baby. He sees a potential enemy. And the road from kicking out the baby from the house or killing the baby is not very long. And I think that the message of ethnic cleansing is the message of criminalizing not the policies of the state of Israel, but criminalizing the state of Israel. And we should do this. We should do this because only a fascist approach to life would say that in every historical condition, a state and the country is the same thing. No, it is not. Sometimes the state is the worst thing that can happen to a country. And the worst thing that happened to Palestine is the state of Israel. And if we want to make the country of Palestine a place where people could live as equals, in fact live in many ways better than in other parts of the Middle East, maybe even better in some parts of Europe, is to bring the country back at the expense of the state. And I know this is not easy. And this is not about questioning the right of a state to exist. We are individuals. We are activists. We don't have the power to challenge the right of states to exist. We cannot eliminate states. Israel has the power to eliminate states. We don't have the power to eliminate states. What we have is a moral power to say to people that the kind of state that you have founded and the kind of state that you are maintaining is destructive to the country in which you exist. It has led in 1948, the creation of that state, led to the expulsion of half of the native population of Palestine. Show me any other situation in history where the international community, under the slogan of peace, would come and say, in order to make this country a peaceful place, I have to kick out half of the people who live there. Only in Israel and Palestine we have this bizarre historical moment where the United Nations, embodying the international community's will, is telling the world that it allows Israel to kick out half of Palestine's population in the name of peace. And once you start like this, the history of Israel, it's very difficult to retract and to explain that actually you have to study history and go back to 1947 and 1948 and say the partition or the idea of partition is an immoral idea. It's not even a good realpolitik idea. But that, of course, you couldn't know in 1947. I can understand that in 1947-48, you would have said, let's see, if we divide the country into two, it may work. Who would have known? But 60 years later, can you argue that dividing this baby, if you want, is different from the Solomon trial? It's not surprising. You all know about the Solomon trial, right? You know about the baby and the two mothers, and that the real mother doesn't want the baby to be cut into two. We know who is the real mother in the case of Israel and Palestine. We know who was willing all the time, supposedly, to petition it. So I think that the whole idea of the ethnic cleansing is connected to the international support for it, not direct support for it. But the agreement and the consent of the United Nations, and later on the European Community, and later on the United States, to say that this is the way peace can only be possible in Palestine, that the Israelis kicked out enough Palestinians and took over enough of Palestine to create the only democracy in the Middle East. They corrupted every commonsensical language that we had in the West in the late 1940s and the early 1950s with the Zionist project. That's how you create democracies? By kicking out the indigenous population so that you can have a Jewish majority? But that's what all young Israelis believe. They learn in the political science department that in order to build a democratic society where the majority can decide what to do, you are entitled first to define the majority, even by means of killing the other side, so that you will be sure what would be the result of the democratic elections. Israelis don't find it at all bizarre that if you create a democracy, you can also perpetrate ethnic cleansing and genocide so that you get the right electorate for the future democracy. But a lot of people in the West will talk about Israel as a democratic state because they would say the majority votes and decides what to do. The fact that the majority has to be kept all the time by ethnically cleansing people, by massacring them, by colonizing them, by putting them in great ghettos like in Gaza, is never discussed as part of the Israeli democracy. And I think we should bring that to the fore, The only way to keep Israel as a democratic state, according to the Zionist ideology, is to continue to be a criminal state. It is almost like allowing people in the worst kind of prison, the worst kind of criminals, to have a democratic system by the force of the gun, by the force of the brutality, by the force of their sheer power. Now, the third and last concept I would like to talk about is, which comes out of colonialism and ethnic cleansing, which are the main driving ideologies behind the Jewish state. Ethnic cleansing and colonialism are the reason that we have a Jewish state in Israel. This is not what we are told, of course, either as Israelis who were born there, and we are not told as people who support Israel around the world. We are told about two very different ideologies. We are told about the need to find the Jews a safe place, and we know it's not a very safe place for Jews. It's the only unsafe place for Jews is to be in Israel. That's what the place where most of the Jews have been dying in great numbers since 1948. And that this is the place that where Jews can recreate themselves as a national movement, where they can exercise the right for self-determination. But we know that Israel is not interested in the right of self-determination for the Jews. This is why it brings hundreds and thousands of non-Jews from all over the world to settle in Israel, because what is important for Israel is not self-determination for the Jewish people. What is important for Israel is to make sure that it's not an Arab state. And if you are a Baha'i and you live on a mountain in the Himalaya, but you are definitely not an Arab, you will become an Israeli Jewish citizen in no time, if you are willing to come over. There's no problem. The rabbis would make sure that you are a Jew, and they may cause you to go through some painful operations, but if you are a man, but all in all, you are welcome because you are not an Arab. And if you're an Arab Jew, you will have to de-Arabize yourself. Otherwise, you will not be welcomed in the Israeli Jewish society. Now, the third and last concept, and then I'll reach to my 30 minutes, is the ethnic purity of the state. And this is related to the right of return. Most of the people, especially some of our best friends, and I mean it not ironically, as I just published a book with Noam Chomsky, I include him in this. Some of our best friends are against the right of return, and their practical explanation. They would say it's unrealistic to tell the refugees that they should look forward for the possibility of returning, that they should be encouraged to think about a different kind of future. And I would say that the departure point for this analysis is not practicality, is not realpolitik, because if the basis for analyzing, as Uri Avneri does and Noam Chomsky does, and all our, and I'm, as I say, I'm not cynically saying our good friends, they are my good friends, but I totally disagree with them on this. If the basis for analyzing the situation is realpolitik, then it means that the balance of power determines your attitude. Well, the balance of power, as we heard yesterday, between the largest and strongest army in the Middle East and the weakest military power in the world, right? If this balance of power determines our attitudes, we shouldn't even meet here today. We should give in to the Israeli dictates. And we know the Israelis are very clear what they want. They want to have as much of Palestine as possible, with as few Palestinians as possible. They wanted it in 1882 and they want it in 2010. This hasn't changed. The means have changed, the historical circumstances have changed, but the vision of what would be a thriving, successful Israeli society is a society which has as few Arabs as possible and as much of Palestine as possible. That hasn't changed. So if realpolitik determines our attitudes, we should give in to this vision. So in any case, we are not dealing with realpolitik when we are challenging what Israel wants. And the reason the Israelis refuse even to acknowledge the right of return, let alone practically implement the right of return, is not because, as some people would think, because they have a very serious conscientious problem of admitting that they have kicked out and massacred people 3 years after the Holocaust. I once thought that this was the main problem, I admit, I once wrote about it. I was hopeful, because I'm optimistic, I'm not very tall, I always see the bottom half of the glass. So I thought the Israelis don't want to talk about the right of return because people who were, like Uri Avneri for instance, were involved in the ethnic cleansing itself, feel unhappy about it. And if you talk about the right of return, you bring... This is the kind of panacea, the remedy for the illness. No, I don't think this has had anything to do with it, unfortunately. It makes a lot of sense from a Zionist point of view to say Arabs are not welcome. Whether these are Arabs we kicked out, whether these are Arabs who we never touched, whether these are Arab Jews who want to insist to remain Arabs, even if they are Jews, they are not welcome. Because we won't be a democracy if these people would come in. That's the major thing. That's the main Israeli refusal for the right of return. So when you support, and with this I will end, when you support the Palestinian right of return, you are not only supporting, which I understand we all do, the right of people who were kicked out to come back if they want to. You are not only acknowledging the crime of the ethnic cleansing in 1948. You are not only abiding by United Nations resolution that very clearly support the right of people to return. You are saying a very simple no to racism. That's what you are doing. You just say no to the only racist state we have in the Middle East. We have not very nice regimes in the Middle East, I agree. The political regimes in the Middle East are nothing to write home about. I would not publicize them as sort of recommendation for future societies to build their politics on this basis. But not one of them is racist. The only racist state is the Jewish state of Israel. And one of the only ways of engaging with this racism is to challenge it on the right of the refugees to return. Not because it's practical or not practical, because it deals with the genetic code of the Jewish state. The idea that you can colonize is not new. But the idea in the 21st century that you can maintain this colonization by openly pursuing a racist, maintaining a racist state, should not be acceptable, especially not in this country. Thank you.
You've just been listening to Ilan Pappe and his talk at a Palestine Solidarity Conference recently in Stuttgart, Germany. We want to remind you that you're tuned to WZBC in Newton, 90.3 FM on your dial, and the program is This Week in Palestine. This Ilan Pappe talk can be viewed online as a video, as I mentioned before, along with other talks at this same conference. Just open your search engine, put in the words Stuttgart, Palestine, and Pappe, that's P-A-P-P-E, and the videos will come up for you. This conference also prepared a closing document. It's really good, I think. And it is also online. The title is simply Stuttgart Document. You can find it easily online. Again, the title, Stuttgart Document. So we'll end our program now. This is Ken Barney thanking you for listening to This Week in Palestine. We'll be back next Sunday.